From Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship, this is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, December 19, 2003. At WBAI in New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez. Ariel Sharon says Israel will unilaterally separate from and further tighten the military fist around Palestinians. Muslims and Christians unite in France over their opposition to Chirac's new law banning certain forms of religious expression. And this week, the Enola Gay went on display at a museum in DC. Critics charge the museum is telling a distorted version of history. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Internet suppliers are not obligated to turn over the names of subscribers when subpoenaed by the Recording Industry Association of America, according to today's U.S. Appeals Court decision. One judge on the three-seat panel said Internet piracy is illegal and poses a direct threat to the recording industry. But according to one advocacy group's reading of the decision, the RIAA overstepped its bounds. Using a 1998 copyright law, the RIAA was able to obtain the names of people from ISP providers without a lawsuit or judge's specific order. So far, the RIAA has filed thousands of subpoenas for the identities of Internet users they suspect of downloading thousands of songs for free and has sued hundreds of others for violating the copyright laws. California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger declared a fiscal emergency on Thursday, taking control of the state's budget without involving the Democratic-controlled state legislature. Brian Edwards Tekert has more from KPFA.
Shortly after declaring the emergency, Schwarzenegger announced $150 million in budget cuts, primarily to higher education and social service programs. Democrats are calling it an emergency of the governor's own making. The money will go to city and county governments, which are projected to lose $2.6 billion because of Schwarzenegger's repeal of California's vehicle license fee. At the time, he said California could borrow the money it needed to balance its budget. Yesterday, a second major credit agency lowered the state's bond rating to near junk bond status. I'm Brian Edwards Tekert in Berkeley.
Eight patients who were treated at a Yale University-affiliated hospital filed a lawsuit this week claiming a variety of financial abuses they say they suffered at the hands of hospital administrators. From New Haven, Connecticut, Melinda Tuhus reports.
In the lawsuit against Yale New Haven Hospital, the plaintiffs charged that they were illegally denied free care, overcharged for services, and/or abused in the collection process. The hospital had been sued earlier this year by the Connecticut Attorney General over the issue of denying free care. Union spokesman Bill Meyerson.
The hospital, after treating patients without insurance or who did not have adequate insurance, pursued those patients unmercifully, attached their wages, seized their bank accounts, placed liens on their homes, filed for foreclosure, even had them arrested and dragged into court.
Over the past year, under intense pressure from a labor community coalition and city and state elected officials, the hospital has already been forced to make significant changes in the way it collects debts and serves low-income patients. A hospital spokeswoman said the lawsuit is part of the union's corporate campaign to discredit the hospital and that the idea that 10,000 people could benefit from winning the lawsuit is ludicrous. For FSRN, I'm Melinda Tuhus in New Haven, Connecticut.
Anti-war protesters who were arrested for trespassing in front of a federal building in Philadelphia the day the United States invaded Iraq this year started their short-term jail sentence. From Radio Volta, Jamie Graham reports.
Yesterday, in Philadelphia, five people began serving federal prison sentences for protesting the war in Iraq. Sylvia Metzler, James Hanlon Smith, Luann Merkel, Tom Mullion, and Marlene Santoyo began serving 7 days in the Federal Detention Center for blocking the doors of the federal courthouse in Philadelphia on March 20th, the first day of the current U.S.-led invasion of Iraq. Federal Judge Rappaport had fined them $250, but last week, Rappaport sentenced them to 7 days after they said that they would not pay the fine. The five protesters are the first of 107 who were arrested in that action to go to jail. More have indicated that they are also willing to go to jail. This is Jamie Graham reporting from Radio Volta in Philadelphia for Free Speech Radio News.
Power plays at the top of Sri Lanka's government could quickly crumble the peace process from the bottom up. Poneya Manikavasagam reports from Sri Lanka.
6 weeks old Sri Lankan political crisis deepened further as the Sri Lankan President Chandrika Kumaratunga and the Prime Minister Ranil Wickremesinghe have failed to reach an agreement on a deadline fixed for this week to decide on who should be in charge of the Defence Ministry. Minister G.L. Pieris, the government spokesman, told reporters the country risks losing $4.5 billion of aid pledged in June by donor countries to rebuild the war-torn nation as the Norway-brokered peace initiatives continues to be stalled. Minister G.L. Pieris warned if there is no speedy resolution to the political situation, it could have dangerous repercussions on the peace process. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ponnaiya Manikavasagam from Vavuniya, Sri Lanka.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
World leaders have roundly criticized Israeli leader Ariel Sharon after his speech yesterday outlined his decision to unilaterally separate from Palestinians should peace talks fail. Under his plan, Palestinians would be denied land that would enable them to establish an independent state and keep them behind a controversial wall that Israel's building that will run through the West Bank. The wall, coupled with Israeli settlement activity, would effectively partition the West Bank into three subdivisions controlled by the Israeli military with the ability to shut down any of the three areas at any time. Prime Minister Ahmed Kurai said he was disappointed with Sharon's, quote, threat and urged negotiations. Michelle Wachowski, longtime Israeli peace activist and co-founder of the Alternative Information Center, offered this reaction to Sharon's speech. He's speaking to us from Jerusalem.
Those who were expecting something new and radical turn were obviously disappointed. And those who are not ready for any kind of measure which could be interpreted as a compromise or some kind of measure in favor of the Palestinians are angry. But basically no one was surprised by the content of the statement, which was almost announced in details before.
Now, it seems to many degrees like Sharon has put out a lot of what Palestinians are calling lies, untruths. He said that the roadmap demands that Palestinians eliminate terrorism and only afterwards Israel's required to fulfill its obligations. What do you make of that?
He lied very openly in his statement when he said Palestinians and Israelis accepted the roadmap. He forgot to say that the government wrote for the roadmap with 14 amendments, each one of them enough to empty it from its content. The Israeli conception has nothing to do with the roadmap anyway, because both sides should stop violence, and the main violence is on the Israeli side, the continuation of the settlement policy. The Israeli government is interpreting it as a two-stage agreement. The Palestinian will stop violence, and then we will see what to do.
Sharon did say that there will be some dismantling of some outlying settlements. Can you tell us what's behind that statement?
Sharon is always, as a good general, understands that you have to sacrifice non-relevant positions in order to strengthen the relevant position. Sharon is not interested to have settlements in the Gaza Strip, certainly not those who are completely surrounded by millions of Palestinians. So he announced that he may be ready to leave the settlements which are in the Gaza Strip in order to strengthen the settlement which matters, meaning the settlement in the West Bank.
Now, Sharon also repeated the fact that what he calls the separation fence, he said it's necessary for security for Israelis. Palestinians are very open about their opposition to it. They call it the apartheid fence. What are Israelis thinking? Do Israelis really believe that this kind of a fence or a wall will make them safer?
A great majority of Israelis, and especially the left, the Israeli left of the Israeli peace camp, was the one who advocate and still is advocating the fence as a mean of security, when security is identified with total separation. The ambition of the left and now of Sharon too is separation. The wall is a tool for separation. A peace treaty with the Palestinians, all are tools to achieve the main goal, which is separation. the only difference between the right wing and the left wing in Israel, between Ariel Sharon on the one hand and the peace, the old peace movement on the other hand, is that while the peace movement is calling for separation, Sharon called it in his yesterday speeches disengagement. In both cases, we are speaking exactly about the same thing.
Just finally, can you tell us, do you think Sharon will follow through? Are these just threats, or will what he said in his speech yesterday actually happen?
It may very well happen. Now, we have a problem with Sharon that he has not all his party and not all his government endorse his conception. And Sharon, while being old, is not ready for big fights. But apparently, what he's intending is to push the Palestinians to reopen negotiations, threatening that he will take one side initiative and hoping that the Palestinians will understand the message and start negotiating on the Israeli, on the basis of obviously of the Israeli condition.
Michelle Wachowski, longtime Israeli peace activist and co-founder of the Alternative Information Center. In a striking blow to the Bush administration's post-9/11 judicial policy, the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco ruled yesterday that the government cannot imprison so-called enemy combatants captured in Afghanistan and held at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, indefinitely and deny them access to lawyers. Max Pringle reports from KPFA in Berkeley.
The 2-1 decision said that indefinite imprisonment is inconsistent with U.S. law and raises serious questions about international law. The government had argued that since the prisoners were captured on foreign soil and were being held outside of the U.S., they could be detained indefinitely and denied the right to meet with counsel. The U.S. has held some 660 foreign nationals incommunicado at Guantanamo Naval Base. The prisoners were captured in the U.S.-led attack on Afghanistan following the September 11, 2001 attacks. Abraham Safair, a senior fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution, disagrees with the court's ruling. He says the Ninth Circuit is notable for its liberal rulings.
And the Ninth Circuit has consistently, for many years now, ever since the Carter appointments to that court, been extremely liberal and reversed repeatedly. Yes, I would think that this is in part a reflection of that problem.
But civil liberties advocates disagree. Dorothy Ehrlich, executive director of the Northern California branch of the American Civil Liberties Union, says the decision is overdue.
We've sort of been waiting for a very long time to have this sort of ruling by the courts that really reestablishes the fact that there are indeed checks and balances and that those checks and balances simply weren't being respected by the executive branch.
A group of clergy, journalists, lawyers, and others sued in district court in California last year on behalf of the prisoners. The case was initially dismissed, but the matter reemerged when the brother of a Libyan man captured in Kabul amended the complaint. Michael Ratner, an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York, says the court has rightly ruled that the designation enemy combatant stretches the law to the breaking point.
What's really happening now, some 2 years after 9/11, is that the courts seem to now understand that the threat to liberty is really great. The idea that the executive can simply label people as enemy combatants, throw them into either Guantanamo or a brig in the United States, and that no court can really review their case, I think is frightening to everybody, and the courts are saying, we're going to look at this situation.
The government made the case that the unique threat from international terrorism, as played out on 9/11, means special measures are required to fight it. But Jamie Fellner with the New York-based Human Rights Watch disagrees. She says the preservation of basic human rights are important, even in times of national emergency.
Even if there is a national crisis occasioned by the September 11th attacks and subsequent events, that crisis does not justify sweeping aside decades of hard-fought gains in the human rights arena.
The government is expected to ask for a stay of the ruling and could appeal it to the Supreme Court. Early next year, the High Court will take up the case of Yasser Hamdi, a U.S. citizen of Saudi origin captured in Afghanistan. The court will rule on Hamdi's right to legal counsel. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Max Pringle in Berkeley.
You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez. For an archive of today's newscast or previous FSRN stories, go to www.fsrn.org. That's www.fsrn.org. Condemnation is pouring in from around the world over French President Jacques Chirac's law banning various forms of religious expression, namely the right to wear a Muslim headscarf, a Jewish skullcap, or a large Christian cross in public schools. Muslims, Jews, and Christians alike see the decision as discriminatory by banning the basic right to express one's faith. And as our correspondent in Jordan, Ulla Farawati, reports, Muslims and Christians are coming together to demand the law be abolished.
French President Jacques Chirac's decision to ban forms of religious expression struck deep chords in the Arab world amongst Muslims and Christians alike, who denounced the decision as an infringement on basic human rights, the right to express faith.
This is a flagrant violation of human rights and looks like part of a global attack on freedoms of faith.
Hamza Mansour is Secretary General of the influential Jordanian political party, the Islamic Action Front.
France is the country of freedoms, and we are sorry to hear this decision that clearly targets Muslims. And I don't think that such a decision will foster relationships between people from different religions. We call on the world to react angrily to such an attack.
As Layla, a 22 Muslim, was leaving the mosque after Friday's Muslim prayer, she said Muslim women are particularly targeted. They are being deprived of the basic right to dress the way they desire.
Muslim women also say they suffer from the unfair stereotype. The Muslim ritual on the dress of women is being criticized globally. First is Turkey, then comes France, all under the name of globalization and secularism. I don't understand. I'm getting married soon. I'm afraid I can't leave Jordan for my honeymoon.
The French president defended his decision by saying that religion should not, quote, interfere with daily life. But people from the three sects, Islam, Judaism, and Christianity, saw the decision as being unfair. Najwan Mserbash is a Christian Arab who lives in Amman.
I don't understand. How can they discriminate against all religions and Christianity as well? The majority of French are Christians. People should understand that they should accept each other no matter what they wear. Looking all the same will not make a difference. It is the heart and mind that are most important, not what we look like.
In Amman, Jordan, this is Ulla Farawati reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
This week, a multi-million-dollar exhibit of 80 aircrafts opened at the new Smithsonian Air and Space Museum. The meticulously restored Enola Gay was among them. And while the exhibit was welcoming hundreds of guests, critics, including radiation survivors, the Japanese Hibakusha, held a peaceful demonstration telling exhibit goers what is missing from the museum's version of history. WPFW's Jenny Johnson has more from Washington, D.C.
This week, the Smithsonian opened a new display of the meticulously restored Enola Gay, the plane that dropped the first atomic bomb on Hiroshima in 1945. Protesters were at the opening because the exhibition does not display the decimation of Hiroshima and the human devastation caused by the bomb dropped from the plane.
My name is Keiko Ogura. I was exposed to the bomb when I was 80 years old. Young generation just adore, oh, that's the great weapon. I don't want them to think so, that because of that great weapon, they say, great aircraft, so many people died. I want to mention that the number of the dead and the real casualty of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But still, if it is used to prevent the future war, that will be very meaningful. So, especially for the young people, think about what the Enola Gay did toward us. That is a kind of warning. We won't have a nuclear weapon anymore.
Tomiko Tominaga was 16 years old in Hiroshima at the time of the atomic bombing. She speaks through an interpreter.
I am the only one that's left in my family, and I am the only one that's left of all my schoolmates. They were all killed. And in fact, a lot of the schoolmates that I saw die right around me, their whole entire families were gone.
Tomonaga was part of a six-person delegation that came from Japan to highlight the history that will not be told at the National Air and Space Museum. The Smithsonian was called on to expand its exhibit to include a balanced discussion of the atomic bombings of 1945, but the Smithsonian refused, saying it would focus on the plane as a, quote, technological achievement. Protesters challenged the assertion that the dropping of the atomic bomb was right. Historian Gar Alperovitz said that military leaders opposed using the bomb, and politicians made the decision, who believed they were doing the right thing for long-term strategic advantage.
The bomb might well put us in position to dictate our own terms at the end of the war. They believed that by establishing a free-trading capitalist world system was the way to produce democracy, liberty, and freedom around the world. They thought they could literally make the world safe for democracy as they understood it. And they thought nuclear weapons would allow them to make the Russians agree and the Poles would agree with this world order, which they thought was a good one.
Hibakusha, the survivors of nuclear radiation, fear that Americans don't understand the grave threat posed by nuclear weapons, pointing to the use of depleted uranium weapons in Iraq. The Smithsonian was called irresponsible in ignoring the human aspect of the Enola Gay's history, especially given the current threat of nuclear proliferation and threats of war. Author Daniel Ellsberg gave perspective through recent tragedies close to Americans.
We just saw in September 11th what two planes loaded with airplane fuel could do properly aimed by people willing to die. They killed 3,000 civilians, an atrocity by any standards. We don't have to ask, really, what two planes with crewed nuclear weapons could have done, because we did that experiment. Two planes with first-generation nuclear weapons killed initially in that first day 150,000, roughly, and another 150,000 over months from the fallout, a total of about 300,000 or 100 9/11s.
Meanwhile, a $6 million defense authorization bill to research the development of so-called mini-nukes was signed by President Bush on December 2nd. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Jenny Johnson.
Yesterday, the Cintas Corporation cemented its place as the nation's largest uniform apparel and laundry services company, posting a 10% increase in second quarter income. Cintas is a darling of Wall Street and a model of corporate success, having earned $250 million in profits last year. But critics of the laundry and uniform giant say that success comes largely on the backs of its workers, from the women who stitch together Cintas uniforms in Haitian sweatshops to the largely immigrant workers who clean uniforms in dangerous laundries here in the U.S. John Hamilton has more.
1 year ago, Cintas employee Miguel Campos had had enough of hazardous conditions in his laundry plant in suburban Chicago. The chemicals on the uniforms and towels he routinely handled left him with headaches and feelings of dizziness and nausea.
There's no such thing as safety equipment. The only thing you could get, you get some gloves, but those gloves are only like cotton gloves. They're not like strong gloves, or no, it's just regular cotton gloves, you know.
Fed up with hot, hazardous conditions and low pay, Campos contacted the Union of Needle Trades Industrial and Textile Employees, or UNITE. But shortly after plant managers got word of his interest in a union, Campos was fired.
They didn't want me there, definitely. Because, you know, since I was young and I knew what was going on with the union, you know, I knew that's why I got fired. In the union.
Across the nation, organizers in other cities where Cintas operates report similar efforts by the laundry giant to remain free of unions.
In the private sector, there's different degrees of opposition, and Cintas happens to fall on the far right of that. They are ideologically opposed to unions.
Ian Gold is an organizer with the Teamsters Union, which recently partnered with UNITE in a bid to organize Cintas laundry workers around the U.S.
This company makes money not on how well they do business, but on how they can cheat their workers out of wages on overtime, discrimination. how little they can pay on benefits. I mean, they really try to push all that stuff onto the workers.
While the Teamsters and Unite have so far had little success organizing Cintas laundry workers and delivery drivers, the unions have turned up the heat on the company in court. Cintas faces dozens of lawsuits, including a class action case filed last month that alleges the company maintains a culture of discrimination in which women and minorities have little opportunity for advancement. Another class action case, says Ian Gold, alleges Cintas withheld time-and-a-half pay from its delivery drivers.
Cintas had classified its drivers as exempt from receiving overtime. And drivers, to get their jobs done, have to work many hours. They're driving all over the city. So whatever it takes to get their job done, they have to do without respect to how many hours they spend doing it. And so by improperly classifying these employees, they've cheated them out of rightful overtime that they've been due.
Cintas's efforts to reclassify delivery drivers as exempt from overtime mirrors a recent move by the Labor Department to amend overtime classifications under the Fair Labor Standards Act. According to the Economic Policy Institute, the changes would spell the end of the 40-hour workweek for a net 8 million American workers, among them delivery drivers like those at Cintas. Winifred DePalma of Public Citizen says the campaign to roll back overtime protections has the support of Cintas founder and chairman Richard T. Farmer, a Republican Party activist and George W. Bush supporter.
Richard Farmer, as a ranger, has been responsible for bundling together $200,000.
DePalma believes Farmer's status as one of only 134 major fundraisers, or rangers, gives the Cintas chairman a hand in regulatory changes, such as the exemption of workers from overtime protection.
It is no coincidence that the same people who are contributing such huge sums of money to Bush are people involved with industries that are receiving huge subsidies, deregulation, regulatory rollbacks. People from their own industries appointed as regulators by the Bush administration. It's certainly not a coincidence.
Critics of Cintas say Richard Farmer's activism on behalf of the Bush campaign and the Republican Party have led to other regulatory changes as well.
They really funded the repeal of the Clinton ergonomics rules.
Pete DeMay is an organizer with Unite in Chicago. He says repetitive motion injuries like carpal tunnel syndrome are common in Cintas's plants and that the company has fought off efforts to impose ergonomic safety regulations.
It's a tale that repeats itself. Women start working at Cintas in their early 20s, and after 10, 15 years of the company, almost invariably they obtain carpal tunnel. Their production drops off, and slowly but surely they get phased out for not being able to meet production quotas.
With the Workers' Independent News Service, I'm John Hamilton for Free Speech Radio News.
Free Speech Radio News is pleased to announce our special holiday documentary programming. Starting December 24th, we'll air a documentary about the prison industrial complex in the post-9/11 climate. December 25, we'll see FSRN reporters reflecting on the news they covered throughout the year, bringing you the behind-the-scenes stories that did not make their final cut. For New Year's Eve, we'll trace the news as it happened this year in our annual special Free Speech Radio News Year in Review documentary. And then on January 1st, we mark the 10th anniversary of the Zapatista uprising in Chiapas with a historical look at the EZLN struggle and how that ties to 10 years of NAFTA. So don't forget to tune in to FSRN amidst your holiday celebrations. Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations WBAI in New York and KPFA in Berkeley, and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. The newscast is produced by Kata Mesta and Simba Russo. Headlines editors are Randy Zimmerman and Nell Abram. Our DC editor is Mitch Jeserich. The technical production team is Jade Paget-Seekins, Pauline Bartolone, Mick Million, and Lindsay Benedict. Web support from Vanessa Tate and Leslie Holmes. Our intern is Bob Stern. FSRN is a worker-run collective, and for more information, visit our website at www.fsrn.org. In New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez.